Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. Tonight, House Speaker Paul Ryan, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, Ultimate Fighting Championship President Dana White, and the General Manager of Trump Winery will speak. The theme, Make America Work Again. Last night, it was Make America Safe Again. We heard from Melania Trump, former Mayor Rudy Giuliani, and the mother of a Foreign Service officer killed in Benghazi. Let's listen.
I blame Hillary Clinton personally for the death of my son. That's personally.
I said Islamic extremist terrorism. You know who you are. And we're coming to get you.
The next First Lady of the United States, my wife, an amazing mother, an incredible woman, Melania Trump.
The race will be hard fought all the way to November. There will be good times and hard times and unexpected turns. It would not be a Trump contest without excitement and drama.
Well, we had both excitement and we have drama this morning. Joining us all week in Cleveland, NPR Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent Ron Elving. And Ron, let's just start with Melania Trump's speech. And I don't want to spend too much time on this, but this is the drama. Even some Republicans are saying that the party should say, oops, maybe we were looking at Michelle Obama's speech and some phrases got in and that's why it sounds so much alike, and just move on and get it off the radar. Your thoughts?
That might be a better solution, but instead last night the Trump campaign issued a statement praising the speech and making absolutely no reference to the controversy, even though it was clearly responding to the controversy. And again today, there is just no backing down on this at all, even though the judge it is to simply listen to the two passages or look at them side by side. There are times when credulity is simply strained when someone says that there is no relation.
Yeah. Well, just talk in general about last night. Boy, we heard passion and Hillary Clinton, speaker after speaker, saying she should be, in fact, in jail. And we heard a mom saying she held her responsible for the death of her son. A lot of passion for Trump, but also against Hillary Clinton last night.
Yes, absolutely. There was an enormous amount of information provided, much of it perhaps dubious in its conclusions, much of it without evidence. But the assault, the indictment of Hillary Clinton was relentless, and the theme of the evening over and over was be afraid, be very afraid. There are terrorists coming to get you. There are cop killers shooting the police in the streets. And there are illegal immigrants who are going to kill your children by whatever means necessary. It was really quite an extraordinary parade.
Yeah. Slate commentator is tweeting out that the message was, in fact, he says more pointedly, be afraid of brown people. We're going to take these topics up again. But I just want to touch on the rules fight yesterday. This was when people who are never Trump types wanted to have a roll call instead of a voice vote. The floor just erupted into just huge people, you know, screaming that their voice wasn't being heard when, in fact, they were denied that roll call. Here's a delegate from Texas, African-American, not anti-Trump, but she just wasn't happy that there wasn't this roll call and there was this upset.
I'm on the side of letting the people vote and having the roll call, and then let's play it out. I want the grassroots to participate fully, and I didn't feel like we were able to participate fully.
Yeah, it was quite a moment, Ron. People are saying they haven't seen that much disruption in a Republican convention for decades. Your thoughts on it?
It's unusual to see the Republicans have a public fight, but in this particular instance, the rule says if seven states' delegations have a majority of their delegates signing a petition saying they would like to have a roll call vote, that is, the kind of vote that we use to actually nominate the president, to approve the report of the Rules Committee, and in this case, the contentious rule was whether or not the delegates are bound to vote for the winner of the primary or caucus in their state. This would unbind the delegates and let people vote their conscience. So they got nine states, a majority of the delegates, to sign on that petition, and they presented the petition, and they were expecting to be able to have that roll call vote. And instead, what happened was that the Republican National Committee forces and some of the Trump people went around and talked back down some of the folks who had signed that petition. They got three states down from a majority, so they only had six states' majorities, and they fell one shy, and they were overruled.
Yeah. Ron Elving, just real quick, we have less than a minute, but most analysts are saying last night the Republicans had a great night in terms of getting their message out to their people. What do you think they have to do tonight?
What they need tonight is unity. They're going to show us 11 senators. They're going to stand on stage, and they're going to say, see, the United States Senate is united behind Donald Trump, and we'll hear from Paul Ryan, the Speaker of the House, as well. Some people will probably point out that that's only one U.S. Republican senator in five who's coming on stage tonight, and that Paul Ryan himself has been quite reluctant to embrace Donald Trump. We'll see how it all plays out.
NPR's. And there will undoubtedly be a surprise, like maybe Donald Trump walking out with a fog base. That was quite something from last night. NPR Senior Washington Editor and Correspondent Ron Elving, thank you.
Thank you.
Well, Ron and Robin giving us a preview of tonight at the RNC. Tomorrow night, it's Donald Trump's vice presidential running mate, Indiana Governor Mike Pence, who's slated to address the convention. Pence served in Congress for a dozen years between 2001 and 2013 and was elected governor of Indiana in 2012. So let's take a look at Pence's 15-year-long legislative record. Brandon Smith is the State House reporter with Indiana Public Broadcasting, and he joins us now. Brandon, welcome.
Thanks so much for having me.
So first of all, tell us, in the 4 years that you've been covering Governor Pence, what has stood out to you the most?
The term staunch conservative is the best way to describe Mike Pence, both in his time in Congress and here as a governor. He's a predictable figure when it comes to his legislative record, his record as a governor. You know what you're getting from Mike Pence, and that's a staunch conservative.
Tell us a little bit more about how that's played out in Indiana.
Well, in his time in Congress, certainly— he was known for standing with the Republican Party the vast majority of the time. He was a staunch opponent of President Obama. For instance, he compared the SCOTUS ruling on Obamacare to the 9/11 attacks, which caught a lot of attention, both positive and negative. Certainly, he voted against the fiscal cliff compromise that made the Bush tax cuts permanent. He also led the charge, really, before a lot of other people in trying to defund Planned Parenthood. It is important to note, I think, that in his 12 years in Congress, including some time spent in a high leadership post there, no bill he sponsored ever directly became law. So a staunch conservative, yet perhaps not a very effective one.
So what does his time in Congress tell us about where Governor Pence might stand on foreign policy issues?
Well, he voted for the Iraq War, which apparently Mr. Trump has absolved him of at this point. And he's also been, in his career, a strong ally of Israel. That we do know.
Okay. Well, let's move to his time then as governor of Indiana. I think many people might remember that it was just last year when Governor Pence signed a religious freedom law that members of the LGBT community and in fact, national business leaders around the country said would worsen discrimination against, again, members of the LGBT community. He then later signed an amendment to protect gays and lesbians. But tell us a little bit more about how that played out in Indiana.
Well, it strikes some of us here at the State House as almost funny at times because it wasn't his issue. As he's been governor, as much as his record in Congress was that of a strong social conservative, he tried to define himself differently here in Indiana. His legislative agenda every year as governor has been focused on economic issues primarily. But the religious freedom bill was something that was sort of dropped on his lap. The difference, by the way, between signing the bill and signing that amendment was literally 1 week.
Huh.
That's how fast that sort of controversy and crisis, if you will, moved. The criticism of Governor Pence surrounding that was perhaps as much about how he handled the issue as it was about the legislation itself. He famously went on national television in an interview with George Stephanopoulos and couldn't answer direct questions about whether the bill in Indiana discriminated against the LGBT community and caught a lot of flack for that.
Wow. You know, we've been talking a lot about social issues because they are playing a very important role in this election. Mm-hmm. But you also mentioned that as governor, Mike Pence really has focused on economic issues in Indiana. Tell us a little bit more about that.
That perhaps shows itself most in the tax cuts that he's pursued. In his first year as governor, it was a 10% income tax cut, not well received by Republicans in this state, who control both the House and the Senate in supermajorities, they fought for the entirety of his first session over that income tax cut proposal, ultimately ended up passing a smaller version, a 5% cut, along with a mix of other business tax cuts.
I've seen that at one time Governor Pence described himself as a Christian, a conservative, and a Republican, quote, in that order.
Yeah, now, he says that a lot.
Yeah, so you followed him closely now for many years. What do you think, you know, his track record in Indiana and his own self-description might tell us about what kind of vice president he would be?
I think it tells us everything about what he wants to be as vice president under Donald Trump, and probably a lot of the reason Trump picked him is that sort of staunch social conservative background, you know, being the Christian conservative Republican in that order. His first allegiance in a lot of ways is to social conservative issues. Issues that have defined him here at the state level, though not of his own making at times, have been things like the religious freedom law. This year, a stringent anti-abortion bill that he signed into law despite the objections of a lot of Republicans in the legislature. That's how he defines himself. That's how he's comfortable with defining himself. And I think that's what he'll bring to the table in a Trump administration.
Well, Brandon Smith is a Statehouse reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. He joined us from the studios of WFYI in Indianapolis today. Brandon, great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me on.
Last night's theme here at the Republican Convention, Law and Order.
Ladies and gentlemen, I would like to make something very clear. Blue lives matter in America.
Milwaukee Sheriff David Clark. The topic is a tender one in Cleveland, which has been under a federal monitor since a 2015 Justice Department report found a pattern of excessive force, including the 2012 fatal shooting of two African Americans after a wild police chase, and then there was the 2014 shooting of Tamir Rice. Tensions show up in street protests. Here's Lizette Luna of the new Black Panther Party.
I want to see all police out of our neighborhoods. If you get called, that's a different story. And when you get called, you don't have to come in aggressively. You can come in, do your job, but you don't have to come in and attack us.
But this week, we met Cleveland Police Captain Keith Sulzer talking to business owners before the convention started.
Just like anything else,
yeah.
If there's an issue or a problem, call 911.
He's a big booster of getting cops into neighborhoods, something scaled way back because of budget cuts. He's the department's liaison to the Cleveland Police Foundation, working to improve the city's image. We met Captain Sulzer and retired cop Bob Gutu, also of the Police Foundation, in Public Square. You can hear there's some sort of false fire alarm going on behind us, but we asked Captain Sulzer first how his department is answering the call for reform.
Well, I think, first of all, if you come to Cleveland, you come to our new Public Square, you're going to see a different Cleveland. You're going to see that it's a really great place. It's a beautiful place. The people are friendly, and it's a very diverse city. The police themselves care about this community, and that's what we do at the Cleveland Police Foundation, is we provide funds so that officers can go out in the community and do good things for people. So if a bike gets stolen from a kid or someone needs furniture, they got evicted from a home, we at the Cleveland Police Foundation provide resources for officers to reach out and help people that are in need.
And Bob, talk more about that, because the Police Foundation, Cleveland Police Foundation, by all accounts, does fantastic work. But when you talk about sending police and doing things with the community, that's what the system's supposed to do. I mean, talk about that, because you're one of the critics that feels that community policing has fallen a little bit by the wayside.
Well, actually, it has. From what we had, you know, in the past, we had a great situation where we had a community policing was over 100 people at one time. And a lot of the officers were in substations, and I was one of them in different neighborhoods.
Talk about that. You mean little mini stations,
that's
literally
exactly
out in the
what they were called, little mini stations. We had one for every ward that covered one for every council person. And that council person had us in a designated station that was okay to you know, that we could get in there and spend some time and get to know the community, work with them, attend the meetings and block clubs, set up block clubs and street clubs. And the people were, they adhered to it. They were devoted to it, as well as the officers, which was important.
And let me ask you too, Captain, this idea of being in the community, as from a current police officer's point of view, what does that relationship with the community do?
Oh, it builds bridges, and the more you know someone, when you know somebody's first name, you feel a little responsibility for them. So what we've done is, you know, all police departments have gotten away with that. We've been more about statistics and about numbers, and that really doesn't tell the whole story. What tells a story is how the community feels about its department. And so that's what we need to do. We need to be neighbors. We need to get to know our neighbors and get to know our neighborhoods a little bit better. And the more you do that, the more responsibility you feel toward that neighborhood.
We let Captain Sulzer go, he's a busy man, and asked Bob Gutu for an illustration of how many stations have worked.
We had an incident where we had an homicide in the area where I worked, and through a total investigation with a couple of the homicide people that I used to work with, they brought me into it. And, you know, through a careful investigation and reaching some of the people that I knew in there, that homicide was actually solved. And I think that's unheard of these days. Back then, we had officers getting information like that. I was getting information that I was relaying to, you know, the drug task force, the drug enforcement, and things like that. We offered the folks in the neighborhood something that they never had before, and that's why it was so well received.
How do you get police departments to begin the community policing or go back to the community policing that you knew when you're part of it?
Well, I attended a conference out down in Columbus just recently for their yearly conference, and they had a group from all different departments I got to address and spoke to them because of my experience with community policing and knowing how it can be a success if indeed it's practiced the correct way. Our officers that are coming on the job now are recruits. They let me go in there and have a couple hours with them before.
They invited you to talk to them.
Yes, they have. And I've told the officers, and the first thing I tell them, I say, you have to realize when you come on this job that there are people in the neighborhoods that will back you. Because all you hear a lot of times, these guys are hearing the negative about people. Well, the majority of people in neighborhoods back the police, and they need to know that. So they do give me a two-hour block, and they do that. But other departments are waking up. If you go to the different websites, you'll see a lot of your suburban departments and statewide departments, they finally realize that community policing is very important. Now they have to have the manpower to apply it properly.
Is the reform that the DOJ report and the commission called for getting done?
I think it is. I've had some talk with the chief, and thankfully he's using people like me who walked the walk and knows what it's all about in the neighborhoods. And again, I keep repeating it, but everybody needs to know that there's good people in the neighborhood. So we're getting that word out, and the chief has made some efforts, some giant efforts in some respect, to get community policing back in the city. It's taking some time, but it's going to happen.
When you say community policing, let's get a definition. Foot patrols are probably never coming back. The guys just walking the beat. What do you mean by...
Well, actually, I have to beg to differ with you. A lot of our districts now, it's up to the commanders how they use some of their people, and they are putting them back in the neighborhoods on foot patrol. That was a very important part of what I was doing, you know, way back when, getting out there. And we would just take every day. We'd either go to a business area and just walk the businesses, hand our business cards out with our phone numbers on, and say, hey, if you got a minor problem, give us a call. Let us know what's going on. And that, in turn, opened up the... You know, the guys in the front lines, I call them our zone car heroes because they really are. Those are the guys that respond to our priority ones and priority twos. So if we handled the threes and fours, kind of like the dogs barking and the abandoned cars, things like that.
Threes and fours, level of, is that, what is that, threes and fours?
Threes and fours is how they prioritize our calls. So if we handled the threes and fours, the number ones and twos, which could be if somebody with a gun, should be faster a response time for the zone car people. So it all works together, and we had a vast improvement of response time way back when we were doing that too. So,
Bob, let me ask you another thing. Community policing in troubled neighborhoods is one thing, but some of the problems, the systemic problems that have occurred lately affect all communities. I mean, you've heard of, you know, black parents having to tell their middle class and upper class kids what to do when they get stopped by the cops. What do you do about changing the perception and the reality for many African-American families that, as all reporting has indicated, they're going to get stopped more often, they're going to get jailed more often? What do you do about that?
Well, unfortunately, with the drop in community policing officers, we were doing actual program that was called What to Do When Stopped by the Police. So we informed the kids, and we were doing a lot of it in high school. They were well-received, believe it or not. I was shocked to know that they were so well-received with the kids in the schools. And we were telling them exactly what to do. If you're stopped in a vehicle, put your hands up on the wheel, illuminate the car if you can, and don't move your hands.
Yeah, but, you know, the black parents say, well, wait a second, how come my kids have to be more vigilant than
well,
other
they
kids?
They don't. We were bringing it. We weren't prejudiced about who we brought it to. So we were taking it to the east side and the west side, all schools. That was very important. I'm glad you mentioned that. And like I said, I was really surprised it was so well received. And unfortunately, again, with manpower, I don't think that program is being put to use as much as it could be, and I think that plays a big part of it. It really
does. What do you do? Cops who aren't getting paid enough, who are being asked to do way more be the social workers of the world. And then you've got African-American families. Their kids are pulled over more often. They're pulled over more often. How do you change that?
You know what? It's going to change, I believe, by, again, and I think community policing plays a big part of it. We need to get these programs together. We need to get people involved in getting to know their police officers.
Well, is it also maybe police officers getting to know African-Americans, if they're not?
Well, sure, and that's not saying. I know a lot of it is training. They're saying, well, we need some more training. That's always been a big complaint here lately. You know, when I was on a job, and I know they still get their diversity training, they do get that. And maybe it needs to be improved a little bit. And we need that rep.
Nothing can replace training's one thing, but I think this is where you were going. Training's one thing, but nothing can replace people just actually knowing people.
Exactly, and until you get the manpower, we can get these guys. We can get some guys, besides answering these priority one and twos, to get down to a meeting, a neighborhood meeting, where we have a group of diversified people from the neighborhood, maybe a monthly homeowners meeting or something, and get some officers to go down there from that area, sit and talk and hear some of the complaints and hear some of it. Nothing beats that one-on-one. And I'm telling you, that's what we had 30 years ago in this city. And like I said, if I didn't live it, I wouldn't believe it. And when it started happening, along with the other 30, 40 officers that were involved in it, we were astounded that the people responded so well. And that was because we all worked zone cars and we were handling these ones and twos, people with guns, kids abused. We seen all that negativity. That's what we couldn't believe. But once we got in this community policing, that now we seen people in a different light. And all they wanted was to live their life quietly and with these quality of life issues, have them addressed, which they were all of a sudden now it's, wow, this is the greatest thing since sliced bread.
And it ended.
You know, abandoned cars used to sit for 2-3 months in the city of Cleveland. When we were there, abandoned car, I could mark it for 3 days. Within 72 hours, I had it towed. So that's the difference. It's not, you know, unfortunately, without this community effort, without the police and the citizens working together. And again, it's starting to improve. I'm seeing a little bit of improvement. I'm not saying it hasn't improved.
It's coming back.
It is, but they need to be devoted to it. And with the DOJ's report, I think it's happening, and it's going to happen even more. And believe me, it'll work if it's done properly.
Retired Cleveland Police Officer Bob Gutu, Community Partnership Coordinator for the Cleveland Police Foundation, a great group. We'll link you at hereandnow.org.
Last weekend's coup attempt in Turkey signaled major political upheaval in the country and economic turmoil as well. Quite a change from the seeming economic stability Turkey had been experiencing in recent months. The Turkish lira had strengthened, the main stock index was up, and Israeli businesses were eager to invest following a mending of relations. And then there was the attempted coup. So what happens now with the Turkish economy? Business journalist Ali Velshi was in Turkey recently, and he joins us now. Hi there, Ali.
Hey, Magna. Good to talk to you, although not a good occasion for it.
Yeah, agreed. So describe to us what impact does the attempted coup have on Turkey's ties to the global economy?
Well, you know, you have to have the context around Turkey to appreciate it. Turkey was a country that under the now president, then Prime Minister Erdogan, really made a push toward trying to fix its economy. They really wanted to push toward joining the European Union, and they had to update a lot of things in their society and economy to do so. And then about 5 or 6 years ago, Europe made it clear that Turkey wasn't really welcome in the European Union. And Erdogan really started to ally with the Islamists and as a result changed the priorities in Turkey. It started facing less west and a little more east. But at the same time, it's a NATO partner and it's the biggest standing army in NATO outside of the United States. So it's our partner in the fight against terror, but it's starting to face east a little more than west.
Mm. And so, I mean, so what impact does that have then on Turkey and its economy? I mean, because at one time, as I remember it, maybe even very recently, like investors and funds
yeah.
looked at it as one of the
sure.
good emerging market countries.
It was like a successor to the BRICS. It was a great place with great stability. Well, what's happened now is increasingly as Erdogan turned east, he started to clamp down on the media. He started to clamp down on opposition. It was not as free and vibrant a society. And this coup has, in some cases, given him an excuse to clamp down more. So there have been mass firings across the government, a clamp down. He's talking about reimposing the death penalty. And it's certainly hurting his relations with the West and certainly in the eyes of investors. We saw on Friday a very steep drop in the value of the Turkish lira. It started to recover a little bit, but it just seems very uncertain.
Mm. Well, so you mentioned the changes that Turkey had made in its hopes of joining the European Union. Very recently, President Erdogan did not dismiss calls for Turkey to possibly reinstate the death penalty. The European Union says if that happens, then Turkey's ascension hopes are gone. They're over. I mean, will this tumult just further then the uncertainty, economic and political, surrounding this very important country?
Yeah, it really does. I mean, the EU is really clear on the fact that you have to do X, Y, and Z to join the EU. But at the same time, the EU really needs Turkey's help because, as you know, many of the refugees coming into Europe have to cross through Turkey, or at least those who were coming from Syria and Iraq. There are fewer of them now, but they want Turkey to hang on to these refugees and help them resettle back into Syria or Iraq once things settle down. So the EU's got to be careful about what it says to Turkey, but absolutely, having the death penalty in an EU country is a non-starter. But Erdogan is feeling fairly emboldened. This is not a good turnout for anyone.
Business journalist Ali Velshi, thank you so much, Ali. It's always great to have you.
My pleasure.
Back on Radio Row in Cleveland at the Republican National Convention. And look, there's a delegate. It's Liz Hausman, a Fulton County Commissioner in Atlanta. She also works at the Chamber of Commerce there. The delegate from Georgia who joins us now. Hi, Liz.
Hi there.
There's over 2,000 of you, and we keep having sightings, and we want to talk to as many of you as we can. And I have to start by asking you about Melania Trump's speech last night. I know you're a supporter of hers, but what do you think of not just the kerfuffle? Look, people have pointed out that her words were very much like Michelle Obama's. There's some thinking that perhaps Michelle Obama's speech was being looked at and phrases were borrowed. But the bigger concern is that the party isn't handling it very well, that it keeps just denying it. Your thoughts on this? I mean, should the party, as some Republicans are saying, just say, look, it was a mistake and move on?
Well, everyone makes mistakes. We all do. But, however, I think that the thing that came out of last night and her really first appearance before our country was to just show the grace and class and beautifulness of her. I mean, she's well-educated. She's well-spoken. She loves her husband. She supports him 100%. She's a good mother. From all accounts.
It doesn't bother you that some of her words might have been taken, cribbed from another speech?
I'm an elected official. I might have perhaps used some phrases from someone else once or twice in my career.
Okay, well, let's listen to Melania Trump's keynote last night and what you liked about it. Let's listen.
I have been with Donald for 18 years, and I have been aware of his love for this country since we first met. He never had a hidden agenda when it comes to his patriotism, because, like me, he loves this country very much.
Liz Hausman, you pointed how lovely she was, former model, lovely. Her dress sold out immediately, apparently.
I'm sure.
But what about the fact that she is an immigrant to this country? And just her very presence reminds people that Donald Trump has been very anti-immigrant, anti-undocumented immigrant, that there might be a disconnect there for some people.
Well, he's calling himself the law and order candidate. That applies to all laws in our country, that we have immigration laws in place. I actually have a brother-in-law that's from Venezuela. He's a legal immigrant. I'm a product of immigrants. We all are. I think that we have laws for a reason. We're in a dangerous world right now. We have to consider that when we let people into our country.
Mm-hmm. Overall, what did you think of last night?
It was great. It was exciting. We had a lot of passion. The focus on our national security is paramount. All the other issues that we can talk about really are insignificant if our country is not secure, if there are bombings here, if we're not free to live our lives. So I think it's very important that we set the stage with that focus on the first night.
You told me right before we went on the air that you really liked former Mayor Rudy Giuliani. Here he is talking about police.
When they come to save your life, they don't ask if you are black or white. They just come to save you.
What else did you like about him?
Well, you know, he lived through the biggest crisis our country has ever faced, and with great leadership. So he understands more than most what it means to be have a terrorist attack. And no one wants to see that ever again on our country. So I appreciated his support of the law enforcement. I appreciated his passion. And I certainly appreciated that he, of all people, could point to Donald Trump and show the country just how important he feels like that issue is in our presidential election.
Did it bother you, as it does, looks, everybody knows that the Republican Party is trying to reach out and grow to minorities, to Hispanics and blacks. There wasn't one acknowledgement that black lives have been lost last night.
Well, so have every other racial demographic. We've lost lives. And we have every demographic in our military, for example, every demographic in our police force. I really don't think they see color. In my county, it's an urban county. It's a majority black county. And, you know, the police are just doing their job. If they and the statistics show in our county that who they pull over matches the population.
Liz Houseman, we got only a minute with you. Send you on to keep enjoying your week here. But we're about to take a look at the platform. Does it bother you that the party platform is far more conservative than your candidate? For instance, he's been more open to gay marriage and gay rights than the platform is at all.
I think historically you might have seen that previously if you compared the platform to the candidates. I think that the president will set the tone and he will, to the best of his ability, live up to our platform. But really, Congress and the local officials have more input in some respects than the president does on that.
Is your party going to unite by the end of the week?
Absolutely. We're very united. I think you saw some expression last night of how we came together, and I think you'll see from this point forward unity.
Liz Houseman, Fulton County Commissioner in Atlanta, a delegate for the great state of Georgia. Liz, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Glad to be here.
And I mentioned we're going to take a look at the platform. There's plenty of routine business that goes on, and that includes approving a party platform. The Republicans' new platform moves the party, as we said, to the far right on a number of issues. But as Anthony Brooks from Here Now contributor WBUR reports, the party platform creates a lot of noise, but maybe little substance.
On the convention floor yesterday, just after party leaders managed to squash an effort by anti-Trump delegates to disrupt the convention, they moved on to the business of passing the new Republican platform.
Is there a second?
Second!
All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye!
Opposed? Nay. The ayes have it.
By acclamation, delegates adopted a platform that embraces some of Donald Trump's pet causes, like building a wall along the Mexican border. It also moves hard to the right on a number of social issues that Trump says little about. For example, it calls for overturning marriage equality, condemning same-sex parenting, and restricting transgender rights. In Cleveland this week, it's hard to find delegates who approve of the entire document, but many are comfortable with a lot of it.
Very much so. For example, I was very glad that part of the party platform was the endorsement of the wall with Mexico, the border security wall.
Tom Mountain is an alternate Trump delegate and the chairman of the local Republican Party of Newton, Mass., outside of Boston. He doesn't like the part of the platform that would restrict LGBT rights, and he says it doesn't reflect Donald Trump's campaign.
What the platform says pertaining to all the gay Republicans and what Mr. Trump believes is two totally different things. Mr. Trump has always been for gay rights.
What's striking about the new platform is how it seems to ignore the so-called Republican autopsy following the 2012 election. Among other things, the autopsy recommended opening the party up to make it more inclusive. This platform, with its tough line on LGBT rights, risks taking the GOP in the opposite direction. Governor Mary Fallon of Oklahoma is co-chair of the platform committee. She told CNN that denying LGBT rights means not giving special rights to a particular class of people.
What we talked about is how can we make America great, and how can we believe and stand for the human rights of all people, not just one segment, one class, one race.
But despite the debate and controversy about the platform, Peter Farrell says it just doesn't matter. Farrell is another alternate delegate from Massachusetts who supports Marco Rubio.
My experience is that party platforms don't have a lot of consequence, and they're often the subject of intense debate. At the end of the day, it's the occupant of the White House that will drive the agenda, regardless of what the platform planks say.
And history is full of examples of that, according to Roger Stone, a former advisor and longtime friend to Donald Trump.
The 1972 Republican platform said that President Richard Nixon would never go to China, nor would we ever recognize them. The 1968 Republican convention said that we would adhere strictly to the gold standard and hard money. Platforms are anachronism. They're largely meaningless.
So why do we do them?
Tradition.
Stone says platforms also please the base of the party, but he says just about everyone recognizes that they're not worth the fight because they're not binding. But Delegate Tom Mountain, who we heard from earlier, says platforms are worth the fight because they send a message about the party, and he's worried about the message this platform sends to gays and lesbians.
It would be akin to making an anti-Israel platform and trying to get more Jews in. We need to get these people in, not because we need to get them in also, but because it's the right thing to do. Otherwise, they're just going to go to Hillary.
Mountain says just when the GOP should be expanding its tent, this platform is telling the LGBT community to stay out. For Here and Now, I'm Anthony Brooks at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland.
We've got the story of a female trailblazer in an exciting and dangerous job. Nancy LaBeouf was the first female senior operator at one of the mightiest dams in the country, the Moses Saunders Hydroelectric Project on the St. Lawrence River in upstate New York. People in New York City, Boston, and Quebec rely on it for power. LaBeouf was a first in more ways than one, though. She retired late last year, and before she did, she gave David Summerstein of Here and Now contributor North Country Public Radio a tour.
30 years ago, Nancy LaBeouf was just a short, wiry 21-year-old. Her dad, a union leader, pulled some strings, and Nancy clambered down metal steps to her first day on the job inside the big power dam.
In February of 1986, this is where I reported to.
The long hallway with the control panels that run each of the 32 turbines. It's called the floor. Nancy LaBeouf looks like she put on her work clothes and promptly shrank. Her maroon work shirt hangs mid-thigh. Her baggy pants are rolled up. Her short white hair, black glasses, and clever smile make her look a little mischievous. But down here, she's pretty much business. We poke our heads inside Unit 29. Its shaft spins furiously.
This is the shaft?
Yeah.
And below is your blades that are turning the water.
Millions of gallons of water churn through the dam underneath us. You can feel a slight shaking.
Now, did you have a degree in electrical engineering or anything like that, or any training?
No, honestly, everything for me was on the job. I am sort of like a geek.
LaBeouf poured through technical manuals, and she watched the senior operators like a hawk.
Everybody was in awe of the operators because they are, to me, the power authority of, you know, making sure everybody's safe. And, you know, everybody works as a team, don't get me wrong, but it's the operators that are here 24/7.
It's the operators who coax 7 million megawatts of electricity from the dam every year. LaBeouf went from apprentice to journeyman. It was a man's world. It still pretty much is. Men far outnumber women on the floor. But Nancy says only one guy said a woman couldn't do the grueling 24/7 shift work.
Shift work's not for women. That's what he'd say. And I'm like, and instead of going, you know, go to hell, you know, excuse my French, I was like, okay, I'm in his territory right now, but I'm going to prove him that there is a place for us.
Nancy patrolled the floor day and night, taking readings, turning dials. She spent so much time down here, she can identify each turbine just by its sound.
So, like, I knew if I was in front of Unit 20, because Unit 20 used to have, like, a hum. So I knew where I was standing at that point.
With that attention to detail, LaBeouf rose to senior operator, the job she idolized. And she became one of the dam's most respected leaders. We take the elevator to a platform outside overlooking the dam. Nancy points to Canada straight ahead. High blue water to the left, white water roiling to the right after its 80-foot plunge through the dam. The shaking has become a faint buzz. Nancy leans against a railing and takes it in.
You know, when you work shift work all your life, you know, you always have your ups and downs with each other because, you know, you're tired this and that. But when anything bad happened or whatever, we were a family and we stuck together.
Nancy's voice trembles. Her face tightens as she remembers. The ice storm of 98, the blackout of 2003, colleagues got sick, passed away. She survived a bout with cancer. And then there was when Nancy came out. She had a girlfriend.
I had a harder time with that with people than I did with anything else. But then I changed people too, because I had guys would tell me, you know what, you changed me.
If you work at a job long enough, your workplace becomes your second home. Your colleagues become your second family. It's where you grew up. Nancy LaBaff was on vacation on a Florida beach when she decided it's time for something else.
I have a bucket list that overflows. It just never fills up, you know. It's just, as soon as I finish one off, there's about 20 more added to it.
Nancy's an endurance hiker, an obstacle course racer. She's going to climb Mount Rainier outside Seattle. This fall, it's the 490-mile pilgrimage of Santiago in Spain. And she wants to pass on her story at the dam to the girls in the LaBaff family.
As being the first female, what was really important to me is being a good role model for my nieces and great-nieces. I want them to see that in a non-traditional field, you can make it if you want it.
For Here and Now, I'm David Summerstein, reporting from the Moses Saunders Hydropower Dam on the St. Lawrence River in Messina, New York.
Well, back to Cleveland. Here we are on day two of the Republican National Convention. And Robin, you've covered many of these. I mean, is this unlike anything you've seen before?
I've never seen so much media, Magna, especially because of the online media here, the Twitter, Facebook, Google. It's just amazing. And we're at the point where people are just interviewing each other here on Media Row. I saw Tom Brokaw interviewing other reporters, Brian Stelter. But lots of excitement about tonight. Chris Christie speaking, you know, kind of the bridesmaid, you know, did not get the VP pick. So hear how he handles that. Ben Carson, Trump children, Tiffany and Don. So lots of excitement about the evening coming ahead.
Well, and we'll be covering it all today and tomorrow. Robin's doing a fantastic job with the Here and Now team there Cleveland, keeping us up to speed. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.